This is the current federal tax developments for the week of January the 11th, 2021. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and we're looking this week at going to really take a look at the interim final rules that were issued by the SBA late on Wednesday, dealing with the new Paycheck Protection Program, second draw program for loans, but also the revisions to the standard first draw program that Congress also extended as part of the law that was signed into law on December the 27th. So we'll talk a bit this week about the interim final rule for revised draws on PPP loans, and then we'll also talk a bit about this week the second draw loan program. So we'll be looking at both of these programs this week, seeing how they're going to work out and how we're going to handle the items. You know, the law itself was passed and signed in on December 27th. I'm going to assume that most of you have had at least some discussion of the law as it exists, but let's quickly kind of summarize what was in this law. As we said, it was enacted on December the 27th, and it made changes to the Paycheck Protection Program loan program. When that includes, that's basically what's going to be referred to as the first draw program by the SBA, and then establish the second draw program. That's the extra program. Now, as you may remember, the basic way that worked is the second draw program is only available to borrowers who have already received a first draw loan and who went out and utilized all those funds on approved expenses prior to getting this second draw loan money in place. And you have to qualify for this by having a 25% decline in receipt for at least one quarter in 2020 compared to 2019. So we have some rules to deal with this. Now, the SBA has announced the program will begin in phases the week of January the 11th. And by phases, we mean that it will first go to community financial institutions, which are small local institutions generally, and it will also initially for 2 days only be open to those who didn't previously get a Paycheck Protection Program loan and so therefore are going to be receiving their first PPP loan. Now, that's kind of an interesting choice in some ways for the SBA because presumably, you know, we're talking about this program saving companies that had already, you know, exhausted the PPP loan program. You can remember that, in fact, we got to the end of the PPP loan program on August the 8th, and there were a lot of companies, you know, there was a lot of funds left over. And definitely there were a lot of companies that qualified to have asked for a PPP loan, especially when we got to the point where if you were asking for $2 million or less, it was assumed that you had a need for it. So a lot of companies simply didn't get involved in the program. Well, it may be that the assumption is at this point, given the surge in COVID cases that have occurred over the past couple of months, that potentially some of those companies that didn't have a problem before might have a problem now. It's not quite sure why, but definitely the SBA is looking at allowing those people in right away. So it'll be that way. Supposedly, after 2 days of the old PPP loan program only being taken, we will then have the new PPP loan 2 that will be in place. You can apply for that again, first from these institutions, later by the larger. Presumably by the beginning of next week, the largers would be in as well. There are also various parts of this program that will be reserved. Funds will be reserved for certain groups and certain organizations. So we'll have to take a look at that. Part of that was because of this belief that the program had favored those who were larger. Larger borrowers got a lot of the money real quick. And the idea was that banks kind of preferred them because they were easier to deal with. They knew how to speak bank. And they also were more profitable customers generally. So the idea is we're going to try to reserve more down for smaller companies. So even, as I say, we've reserved some for very small banks. We've reserved some for not quite as small, but, you know, still under $10 billion in asset banks. We've reserved some for the first program. You know, we have various carve-outs. Some have been reserved for small businesses in, let's say, be low-income and middle-income locations. but not so not high income. So you have to figure out where your company is in that phrase. So there are all these little categories you can fall into. So yeah, it's a little more complicated in that way. All of these programs will end on March the 31st of this year. So it's a first quarter only program. You're not going to be seeing this these loans go out beyond the first quarter. So again, it's a short run program. So we got a quick time in, quick time out. That should be obvious then to anybody listening to this, that if you're going to assist your clients in this program, it's not one of these things you can wait till after tax season to figure out how the program works after tax season. Except for applying for forgiveness, it won't matter how the program works, basically, unless they extend it again. So if you're going to be involved in it at this point, yeah, you got to kind of get involved right now. There's not going to be a choice to wait and pick up this after tax season. So because of that, we're going to talk about what happened this week. The SBA issued two interim final rules on January 6th. Now, that actually was the last day they could issue these IFRs because Congress had charged them within 10 days after date of enactment, they had to publish these rules and, you know, to give guidance on how the program would work. Well, the problem obviously became that, you know, 10 days is short, and there were a few things happening in Washington on January 6th you may have heard about. I won't talk about those in any detail, but basically these guides came out. I think I remember them being released, and I first saw about them very quickly. I saw the posting go up. It was just about when I found the first notice I read online. It was about 9 p.m. in Phoenix, which is 11 p.m. Eastern. I think they went up about 10 p.m. Eastern. So, yeah, they were late that day, but they did get done within the 10 days. I guess theoretically we're still good on them. And they issued them as two sets of rules, although we'll kind of talk about them as one from the beginning here. There was first the interim final rule, RIN 3245A862. This one deals with the old PPP loan program. As I said, that program reopens. We're going to have it again. So if your clients, if you do have clients that didn't borrow on the new program, for whatever reason, didn't go out and get a loan under the new program, they can now go out and get that loan under the new or the old program, I should say. They can go out and get that loan under the old program. And again, there are some real advantages to that. It's A, we don't need any drop in revenue. B, the top limit is $10 million. C, you know, yeah, you know, there are all, so a lot of these rules that we're going to see in the PPP2 loan program don't apply here. So there is a disadvantage, I would say, though, if you are in the food, let's say restaurant or hotel industries, we'll find out that the second draw program gets you a bigger loan, but you have to have already gotten first draw. So, you know, that's kind of negative. If your restaurant is in trouble now, you're going to have to try to get through second draw and first draw within the one quarter. That could be challenging, shall we say, in terms of timing. Then we also got the second regulation, which is a little bit smaller. It's the one that outlines the second draw loan program. You might wonder, well, why is that one smaller? Well, what they did actually was, first thing is, the regulation on the first draw program, they actually just went back, and instead of leaving all those individual IFRs that you had to kind of add up to get to the comprehensive guide about the program, they decided to essentially, well, why don't we just start over, get all the old ones together, and then add and modify information in there. So everything is about the first program is in the first interim final rule. And then the second interim final rule only deals with those things that are different about the second program. So for that reason, it is a little different structure. It's also weird, too, because the first one is still written in that question and answer format that we kept seeing in the IFRs for the regular PPP loan program. The second one's written more like a standard reg you might have been used to from IRS, from the IRS, in that, you know, it's just a bunch of, you know, topics and listings of description of items on them. There's not that question and answer style format that they used for the main PPP loan program regulations. So yeah, they're a little different. They also did a third document release at the same time that outlines, you know, all the things that'll be reserved. A lot of it is fluff about how wonderful the SBA's program is and all those sorts of things. But it does have information about the reserved items. So we have that part in there as well. So let's talk about some of the things for the first draw loan program first. So first thing we want to say is that the program will reopen on January the 11th. So we should see the Loan One program on the 11th, and then we should see the second draw loan first show up on the 13th. Now, that said, I've already read some reports of some of the banks, because all of the details, the forms and how the software is going to work for the banks and all of that stuff actually didn't get out until late on Friday night. So there are banks that are already saying, those that would qualify to go right away, that they aren't going to be ready to start on that date. And in fact, they don't know if they'll be ready to start, you know, until maybe late in the week or early the next week. So yeah, it may be fun if your client wants to be signing up on day one. And also, it's going to be a little fun to find out about how to do that, since I suspect banks didn't know how the program is going to work. And by the time they did find out how it's going to work, most banks were not open, you know, for this or for business. Your clients may have trouble figuring out if their bank's going to be part of this or not. So just be aware, we have a little fun problem here. If your client wants to be right away and get their money, it may take a while. So we'll just have to be, I guess, kind of look at it and be patient, unfortunately, on that part of it. Now, let's talk about some of the major changes in the FIRST program. Okay, and this is just broadly talking about how the FIRST program is going to work. FIRST program is basically the same as it was before, with the following key changes. There are four new categories of expenses, and they're basically the four we discussed when we previewed the problem solvers bill a couple of weeks ago. Now, as I kind of note, I want to remind you, this bill is not identical to the problem solvers bill. So what we discussed a couple of weeks ago, while that formed the real, clearly, it was what was used as the way they moved forward to get to what we have now. There are some places where there are significant differences between the problem solvers bill and this bill. And some of the obvious ones were that we did not get a simpler method, for those who had a loan between $150,000 and $2 million. That would have let you do a lot less submitting of documents. That didn't make the final bill. There are various other things that cropped in, so you got a lot of details. So certainly, if you're still looking at that program from a couple weeks ago that talked about the initial problem solvers proposed bill, please be aware, as I said on that program, I told you things probably would change, and yeah, they did. So again, we've got that. We have been doing sessions, and I did sessions this week that were going over the bill. I'm still scheduled to do a few more this month. So we're going to be doing those four-hour sessions of all the stuff in the bill and walk through this in detail. Now, some of those sessions got done before the IFRs came out. Of course, we're doing others later. So I'm talking about the IFRs this week. So if you actually did attend a course this week, any course except the one I did on Friday for Hawaii Society, where we had the IFRs and I could incorporate those into the course, this is kind of the add-on continuation of some more details about what we've discovered from the IFRs that we didn't know, you know, when we were just looking at the bill itself. That's part of what we got here, kind of how this is going to work, how this runs. Okay, we did add a very minor amount of things to payroll costs. Group term life turns out now to be a payroll cost. As well, we're able to add in disability policies. You know, they also decided to state openly that vision plans and dental plans were considered medical expenses, but we already knew those were considered, right? If you remember, we got an IFR that told us quite a while back, or I guess it was in an FAQ, that, yeah, you know, those group, you know, plans for vision, those group plans for dental, they were considered medical coverage. So, you know, that part of the law, they just codified it, but we already knew that. We got a simplified one-page form that we're going to be able to use for forgiveness for loans up to $150,000. So we'll get that issue. And we also said, as we mentioned, and this was part of the original bill, that, you know, the employee retention credit is no longer going to be off limits if you got a PPP loan. That's kind of a big deal, shall we say. Okay, but let's take a look at now what exactly was in that first IFR for these economic, for these basically first draw loans. And inside the IFR, there are a few things clarified. One of the key ones, which is kind of nice, and it's just a little throwaway thing at the start, we talked about the fact that EIDL advances no longer reduce your forgiveness for your PPP loan. You may remember we had a quirky problem eventually that they had to solve. They were trying to solve it one way, but they end up having to do exactly what the law said because they couldn't get EIDL advances out fast enough. So if you like had gotten a $250,000 PPP loan and you got a $10,000 EIDL advance grant, you know, that thing that was just the money up front, was supposed to be in your money for within 3 days, that clearly took more than 3 days to get. The theory is that my $250,000 initial loan, I qualify for full forgiveness on paper, did all that. But when the SBA went to look at it, they'd say, oh, you got a $10,000 advance. So they would reduce your amount they would give to the bank down to $240,000. And you would still owe the $10,000 plus interest, and that you would have to pay back. And you were technically paying back the PPP loan, not the EIDL grant. But let's be honest, you were paying back the EIDL grant. Well, the law said, okay, we understand, that's kind of dumb. We're going to undo that. The concern we had was, what if your client had already gotten forgiveness? Because some people had. And if you already had forgiveness, it was kind of an issue of, well, we've got this note to pay, right? We're told this $10,000 due, here's your payments, you need to start payments as of day X because you're going to pay back this loan. And of course, having already now gotten forgiveness, you triggered the start of your payback period. And some people have already paid on those $10,000 loans, and they wouldn't necessarily be $10,000. They could be anything up to $10,000, probably an even $1,000 amount, because that's how the SBA effectively decided to do it, was by number of his employees and giving you $1,000 per. So, you know, you got this amount back. Well, in the IFR, they clarify, and they did what I thought they had to do, but they've now openly said it this way. They've already said that if somebody had already applied for forgiveness, if there had already been an offset so their forgiveness was reduced, that the SBA will now go ahead and give the bank the offset, you know, the $10,000 or whatever the number was, plus the interest involved. That means that your account should show an overpayment, and the bank is supposed to send that money back to you. So in theory, we will make everybody whole, even if they already had received a, you know, forgiveness and they started paying on that amount. We're going to go ahead and say, okay, guys, we're going to go ahead. You're still going to be just fine. We're not going to cause you that problem. They also clarified, we had these special rules that allow you, if you had gotten, in certain cases, a PPP loan, and it was not the max amount that you could have gotten, and there are various conditions. They went in and said, well, if that happened, then you could go back and get a larger, you could basically get the difference as a second payment, even though you'd already theoretically gotten your one PPP loan. Well, they went in this case and explicitly said in two other cases, we're going to make it very open because the law wasn't totally clear here, that you actually can go back and still get the larger loan. The first one, relatively clear. They actually put out an FAQ on this earlier, but now it's in the actual regs. And what they're going to tell us is that if you were a partnership that went out and got your PPP loan early, and this generally happened to partnerships that went out and got their PPP funds early, the initial program just talked about paying for employees of the partnership, didn't say what to do about the partners. In a lot of cases, the banks therefore only issued the loan based on the employees. And by the time the SBA finally got the guidance out on the self-employed, well, you know, they had already had their disbursement. The documents had already been filed with the SBA. And theoretically, it was felt, well, we can't make a second payment. Well, they're going to say now, yes, you can. I should add, they already had that, but it only applied. It was a little weird if they hadn't already sent over the final documents. So this says, nope, those people can now go out and they can actually still get their full PPP loan amount. We can go ahead and give them the money for the partners now. As well, the law, and I think we discussed where there's going to be a change, we're actually going to define who was considered, you know, who is considered to be a seasonal employer. And the new law expanded the time period over which you could test your revenues. You know, you could run these 12-week periods to find the best 12-week period that would give you the biggest loan amount. And they decided to take it out for the full year now. So it actually is a full 1 year period. So you can find your best 12 weeks in the 1 year period to apply for. Well, obviously that means that some seasonal employers will now discover that they really would have qualified for a larger loan. Again, they've made it very clear that you can go ahead and ask your bank to send you the additional amount. Now, I should say in both cases, it's worded, essentially stated that you can request. It didn't state the bank had to pay. So there's a little concern here that, well, that's great, but if your bank has decided that they don't want to have anything more to do with the PPP loan program, you might not get that extra money. So we'll see how that goes. That's one to keep your eye on. They also clarified, they added a neat one here. And if you remember the first program, it probably makes sense to do this. The law itself says when we go to get our loan, and this applies to both the first draw or the second draw loan, you know, we have to compute our payroll costs. And the payroll costs were for a period, and the old law kind of said, you know, the 1 year before. And the SBA has said, well, we're going to just say calendar year 2019 instead of worrying about having to have everybody kind of do it as the exact 1 year before. Well, the new law now again said, you know, new law basically put that in and said, okay, calendar year 2019 or the 1 year before you apply. So, you know, and obviously the 1 year before you apply here, when we're looking here in buyout in 2021 is going to include mainly 2020 years. Well, the SBA has said, okay, just like last time, you know, that 1 year back is such a mess because it goes exactly through the day you apply, which means you got to run numbers and then, you know, hold and submit, and it's messy and it's an odd cutoff, and it means lots of weird documents to prove the number if you have to, so you had the right loan amount. So what we're going to do is we're going to say you can use 2019, 2020, or if you really want to, you can go ahead and use that 1 year prior to the date you applied. Although even the reg, they say they figure that most people are going to use one of the two calendar year options because it's a lot simpler for submission purposes. So based on that, though, we do have that. And that option to use 19, 20, 21 applies all throughout this. So it's both for payroll costs for the actual employees. It's also for the sole proprietor or for the self-employment income of partners. All of those things have this 2020, 2019, or 1 year prior option. So we've got that. Actually, I think for self-employed and partners, it's just the 2019 and 2020 options. So, you know, it's kind of interesting, but that's how we're doing this thing on this particular run. Okay, now they also added something that probably could have been in there before, but they hadn't, but now they do it because they said, well, realistically, giving these types of entities loans is not really doing something that the program's meant to do, which is preserve businesses. If your business is permanently closed, you cannot receive a PPP loan or PPP2 loan. The concept being, as the SBA says, it preserves funds for operating businesses. And realistically, the purpose of the program is to keep people in business and make sure jobs stay put. And if the company is closed permanently, well, kind of like that ship's already sailed. So you have to have a business that is not permanently closed. They did say, though, that that doesn't mean that if you're closed right now, you can't do it. As long as you intend to reopen, you can still have the PPP loan program or the second draw loan. So conceptually, the idea is, yeah, you know, even if you're closed right now, because we also know at this point in time, there are parts of the country that are under a very strict lockdown with the explosion of COVID cases and the explosion of people in the hospital. So because of that, you know, there are definitely locations where the smartest thing to do was just to close down. If you're a very high-end restaurant, you know, where you live on the sit-down experience, it's not going to exactly be the same sending out that fine meal in styrofoam containers for delivery or to go. You know, you might have said, yeah, we're just going to have to close and reopen when we can actually have people in the restaurant again. You can still get this. You can still get this loan. You can use it for things. The theory being it could help you survive the totally closed period. Again, you still have to spend 60% of your money on payroll costs. So it don't forget that. That's still a key issue. If you want to know where people are probably going to get in trouble the most in problems they're going to have with forgiveness on the first loan, I think the most often thing I've heard from people teaching various courses and teaching various sessions, both to CPAs and non-CPAs, is, well, we've been closed ever since March, so we haven't been able to pay the payroll. It's like, yeah, you got to get the payroll paid. You're allowed to pay people not working for you. But you can't really take this loan if you're not going to get the payroll paid, or I'll rephrase it other ways. If you take the loan, you could take it, but you're not going to get forgiveness if there's not payroll in there, or you're going to get limited forgiveness. You've got to get the 60% rule. That is kind of the one absolute. I can do a lot of things. If I meet the 60% rule, I actually can have a huge reduction in FTEs and still be fine, but I got to meet that rule. Another one that you should be aware of, because we've talked a lot about the alternative covered period for payroll, that alternative covered period for payroll, the one that said, we can tech covered period won't start for payroll only. It will not start on the date the money went in your bank account. It rather will start on the day that, your next pay period begins, as long as you paid at least biweekly. And conceptually, the idea of that was, well, that aligned your covered period with your pay periods so that you wouldn't have a partial pay period in your last covered period. Under the law, as Congress passed it, we now define our covered period as the period beginning on the day the money goes in your account and ending on a day between 8 weeks and 24 weeks, after that date, and you pick the day. Well, obviously, they're saying, look, you don't need to worry about it. If you want that to align so there's no, miscellaneous excess to be, divided payroll on that final, the final payroll, you can go ahead and just make sure you just define your covered period as ending on the last day of pay period. There's no reason to have that delayed start date, their theory is. For most people, unless you're going out the full 24 weeks, this is not going to cause you a problem. Obviously, if you go out the full 24 weeks, then yeah, we're losing, because this period, your payroll covered period can't move beyond the 24 weeks from the day you got the loan funded. But I think since that's way more than enough to pay out the 2.5 months worth of payroll, my guess is you're probably not that worried about getting the full 24 weeks, getting those few extra days in your pay period in at the end. So in any event, though, the alternative payroll covered period will no longer be a thing. It will no longer be mentioned on the form. So, you're going to need to be aware of that. We've changed how those things work. So next up, let's talk about some more things here. We're going to move on to the second draw program. So those were the big things we found out in the IFR beyond what we already knew about the changes to the first draw programs. Now, generally, everything that applies to the first draw programs applies to the second draw. And in fact, they tell you right off, one of the first things in the IFR for the second draw program, we're told, is that all of the FAQs and all the other guidance the SBA has issued on the first draw PPP loan program applies to the second, except where the new guidance tells you, nope, that doesn't apply here. So basically, the PPP2 loan program, the second draw program, is built on the base of the first. Now, again, reviewing how that program works, you have to have gotten a first draw program. You have to have spent all the funds from that program on allowed expenses before you get any money on the second draw program, right? You have to show a drop in revenue. You have to be able to show a need, right? A 25% drop in revenue. Generally, the max loan is the same as the first one with one key caveat. If you are in an NAICS 7-2 business, which if you go that, and that's like the first two characters of your 8-character, NAICS code, begins with 7-2. That's in the accommodation and food service industry, so roughly hotels and restaurants. You will be able to get 3.5 months of average payroll, not 2.5 months. So that's the big difference on what you can qualify for under this program compared to the first one. So restaurants, etc. Restaurants and hotels, they can qualify for that 3.5. And again, restaurants includes lots of businesses. Like, you know, I've been talking to some franchisees for an ice cream outfit and did a program for them earlier this week. And, you know, that's considered a restaurant. There actually is a Code 72 category that covers specifically ice cream parlors. So basically, they're considered restaurants. So you're again looking for those Code 72 items for that. Now, there is one thing, and I mean, I kind of understand the why of this, but I also understand that it's got a problem too. If you really want to, you don't have to do the quarterly 25% reduction. You can actually do it on an annual basis if you wish. Now, the advantage of the annual basis reduction is you take the 2020, let's say, you know, tax return, business tax return, be it Schedule C, be it 1120, 1120S, 1065, and you take the 2019 version, and all you look for is did 2020 in total drop revenue by more than 25% than 2019. Now, clearly, that's not as favorable to a taxpayer as doing it quarter by quarter normally. But conceptually, the idea is, well, if you've dropped at 25% for the whole year, you have to have at least one quarter that dropped by at least 25%. And number two, you know, if we do it that way, you can just submit your tax returns to prove everything and we're done. Otherwise, you're going to need some other type of detail because your tax returns, generally, A, your, like, you know, your 1120S does not have quarterly income on it. And so, and, you know, basically the same thing for this year, you know, we're going to have to pull things out. And quarterly income also wouldn't require, therefore, the tax returns be done because, you know, it's quarterly, right? We can get that. We know, you know, we basically should have our accounting together for three quarters of 2020, and we may be working on quarter four, but we, in theory, could make the application right away based on the fact that we know from what we have if we've dropped 25% in the first, second, or third quarter. And we probably have a really good idea about quarter four as well. So, again, this is here. The problem, obvious, you got to have the tax returns filed. So we need to get the tax returns done before we could use that special exception. And this year, probably with a late law change, I wouldn't be surprised to see the IRS be very late in getting out the forms this year, which means that, yeah, it may prove difficult to get the data together and get everything to the banks in time to get the PPP2 loan, or you're going to get it late in the program. And if your client needs money today, my guess is this exception definitely is not going to help you today. You really can't file a 1065 today for 2020 because the IRS isn't accepting 2020 1065s. Pretty sure that's true at this point. I don't think enough forms have been released for electronic filing, either by the IRS or updated yet by the software companies, that would allow you for almost any 1065 to start to get it filed so that we could start that process. So, yeah, I mean, it's a benefit maybe. If you've got somebody applying after you finish their 2020 return and they have that 25% drop there, it could simplify the application process. But, yeah, it's just you got to have the return done, and that's saying a lot at this moment. We're trying to apply potentially this week. It's not going to happen. One of the more important things in the IFR is the definition of gross revenue. Remember, we're trying to show that gross revenue dropped by more than 25%. Obviously, the question becomes, what's gross revenue and how do we compute it? Well, the SBA, now, I'm not thrilled with how they wrote the sentence because they bury the lead. You know, and it's there and we'll go through that. So I'll start taking you through it and you discover eventually what I mean by they buried the lead. Because I've had a lot of people who start reading the sentence and then go off and are trying to find financial statements. Well, and what if we're cash basis tax, accrual basis for financials? Maybe we got, you know, other, you know, what method? How do we do it? How do we submit it? And we have an answer here. But as I said, you got to keep reading beyond the very beginning of this provision to find out about, oh, they finally say a magic word that tells us this is how we're supposed to do it. So it starts out by telling you the following about how we're supposed to do this. So gross revenue is all revenue from the sales of products or services, interest, dividends, rents, royalties, fees, or commissions, And you take that number and you reduce it by the returns and allowances. So essentially, it's every type of income is where we get that drop in gross revenue. Now, what they then say is generally it is total income plus cost of sales. And they talk about that then. And now suddenly it seems like, well, they're talking about the Schedule C income, just Schedule C or the 1065. And they're looking at total income and adding back cost of sales. That's income before deductions. And you'll see that total income line on a 1065 or an 1120S. So it's pretty obvious. And the only thing they're going to say is, well, you can generally take that number and add back cost of sales. But then they also say, but if there's any capital gains or losses in the number, you're supposed to take that out as well. So it's kind of interesting how we arrive at that and getting there. And then I told you they buried the lead. Oh, and by the way, the definitions of all these terms comes from the IRS forms. So what are they really saying? It's a tax computation, tax basis revenue. So if your tax, if your client is cash basis for tax, we're looking cash basis. If your client is accrual basis for tax, we're looking at accrual basis tax for this purpose. If your client is a construction contractor that uses percentage of completion method, we're looking at PCM, right? Tax PCM for this purpose. So yeah, you know, whatever the tax law says, that's kind of how we do it. So as I said, they buried the lead way toward the end of the slide. Yeah, the tax return. We're looking at the way you compute it for the tax return. That's fundamentally our number for the gross revenue. So, okay. And my thought after I saw that was, well, it would have been nice for you to do it first before I started worrying about how we did this and what are these options and how would we submit it. It's like, yeah, you kind of buried the lead. Now, they do tell us some things you can pull out of what otherwise might look like gross revenue. It does not include if your client collects sales tax, let's say, for the state, that they're going to then submit back to the state. And let's say they include it in their gross revenue on their return. And then in the general expenses, they basically tiered as a deduction what they paid the state. Well, those taxes that have been collected for the state, the city, whoever else is in there, those are not part of gross revenue. You actually can do that. Also, if you have related companies that sell goods and services to each other, you can pull out transactions involving this, your company, when you sell to an affiliated company, right? This sort of, we're not really selling to the outside world. We're selling to an affiliate. This can be important for consolidated groups and the like, because there are things you're going to eliminate. Well, we're going to be allowed to effectively eliminate these items when we are computing the gross revenue. We can pull those things off. So that'll make that one simpler. Also involved here, we don't worry about amounts collected for another by a travel agent, a real estate agent, advertising agent, conference management service provider, freight forwarder, or customs broker. This is looking at the type of things where essentially, you know, just like, you know, a travel agent might, it's in the old days, we actually tend to use these a lot. You know, you would actually give them the full airfare. And then they'd turn around and they would essentially send the airfare less, you know, and whatever their commission was, onto the airline that they were going to be paid for having sold the ticket. Well, you know, now, of course, you know, it's like, well, we really shouldn't charge them with the sale of the airline ticket, because that's really a sale on behalf of, that's really the airline sale. That's not really a sale of the travel agency. And the same thing there with conference management companies. They may be collecting the fee for the call and other issues, but you know, but they're not really, they're just getting a commission for having done it. So all those things are not really going to be there. Customs brokers, freight forwarder, real estate agents. If you're collecting money for somebody else, that's not going to be considered revenue, they said. Basically, you can go ahead and ignore that. But there's also some things you cannot ignore. If somehow in revenue you get some subcontractor costs that are being run through, so you're being paid something, and I think what they're looking for there, I think their concern there was that if you're a construction company, what you might do is say, well, you know, we're the prime contractor, but you know, we're being paid $20,000 right now on this project, but hey, we're going to assign like 10,000 of that to the following six subs on the deal, because you know, we're not doing the electrical work, We're not doing the roofing. We're not doing the HVAC. So, you know, basically they're saying, no, you can't take that out in that scenario. That's not considered a cost. You can do that. Also, reimbursements for purchases a contractor makes at a customer's request. Again, they're worried that people would say, well, you know, I really went out and bought that lumber and those, you know, and the bricks and the wiring and everything. Well, you know, because it was for the customer and I'm just, you know, doing what they asked for. It's like, no, that's really part of your product. So you're not allowed to do that either. They also said, look, be aware, and you already kind of knew this if you looked at what they told you right up front was income. You don't get to take out your investment income. Investment income is still part of this. Or if you're, you know, and also you can't say that part of what you're receiving is you're being paid for employee costs. So, yeah, you know, they're looking at people trying to say, well, really, you know, this amount of my revenue represents money that's really going to the employees who are doing the services for this. This part really relates to, you know, the materials that's going into the person's home. This part relates to my subs. They're saying, yeah, don't try that. You know, don't try to tell me that this theory that all of this is being collected indirectly for a third party. Yes, I realize you're going to pay third parties to do it. Generally, we are. You know, and that there could be an employee as a third party viewed that way. But we're not going to say that everything you do, therefore, is all, that only your profit counts as revenue. So, no, you can't drop it down that way. If Congress wanted to be profit-based, they would have done it that way. I've gotten this question a lot, and they do explicitly cover this here. Many people were worried that, wait, you know, last year in the fourth quarter, I got my PPP loan forgiveness, which, you know, the 2.5 months worth of payroll. Isn't that revenue? The ruling makes clear, and you should understand what we said it was going to be tax basis anyway here at the end, that no, it's not revenue. I always said that'd be kind of absurd, you know, for Congress is to say that's revenue when this whole thing relied upon you having to get in the first loan. So yes, the SBA says, yeah, don't worry, that's not revenue. That's not what we're going to do. Also, for the PPP loan too, just want to remind you, even though you're going to see 2019 only listed as what you could use for payroll costs or 1 year back from the day you apply, this also allows us to use 2020 numbers for that purpose. Also, there is a special extra money if you are a farmer or rancher that is self-employed, that you're going to be able to get extra money under the program. You know, you can basically, what you can do as a self-employed, at least theory you can, instead of using your net, you can use your gross, much like you can for self-employment tax. In this case, though, you'll use your net income or your gross income. Well, obviously, your gross is more than your net. Now, it's still limited to $100,000 annualized. So bottom line, if you're a farmer or rancher, showed more than $100,000 worth of income last year on their Schedule F, it really doesn't help either way, which you can do it. But this does count for both the original loan and the IFR makes clear, yes, it also works for the PPP second draw. That's not a problem. Now, there's some special things about that restaurants and hotels NAICS Code 72 rule. The law just talked about doing that times, you know, for full year people. But the IFR makes clear that 3.5-month multiplier can be used even if you also want to use the seasonal employer test or rule, or you want to go ahead and be using the rules that apply if you are a new company. So it's not just for people that were in business for all of 2019 and do not want to use a seasonal test. You can do seasonal and still use a 3.5. Also clarify that multiplier works for income replacement for a partner or an S corporation, or I should say a partner or a self-employed person. So you can use 3.5. That makes sense because obviously we're getting 3.5 of the salary paid to shareholders or to, you know, to basically to employee, to employee shareholders of an S corporation or a C corporation. Doesn't make sense why we couldn't get the 3.5 months for the self-employed. So they say that's true. There is one caveat though that could cause a problem if you haven't been really careful with your business activity codes. The SBA makes it clear that you have to have a 72 as the business type code on your tax return, the most recently filed tax return, for you to use the 3.5-month multiplier. And I wouldn't be surprised to see them knock it down to 2.5 if you have a 7.2 in there. Now, I actually said two things, because I realize you say just that, you know, people are going to call accounting firms restaurants. They said, so you really have to be in the rest, you have to really be in a business covered by it, and you have to have said so on your most recently filed tax return. Now, does that mean you should go back and amend the return if you didn't? I guess potentially. I mean, you're really not asking us any more money in, but you're saying this is what we are. That, you know, the catch is going to be how long is going to take the IRS to process that, especially if the SBA does some back checking to see how this is going to work and, you know, tries to see, you know, are we really going to buy this theory of that you're a restaurant? But again, restaurants get 3.5 months of payroll, not 2.5, restaurants and hotels. Anything with a 72. Okay. Now, how do you apply for the second draw loan? You're going to apply on Form 2483 SD. The SBA put this up. Whoops. The SBA put this up. Let me really slip for a second there. On their website on Friday. So we actually saw a draft, you know, the actual version of the form. Now, lenders can use their own equivalent. I would say that probably 95 times out of 100, you're going to be using a lender version of this form online, not the SBA's paper version, but the SBA's paper version at least can be used right now to help clients figure out the data they've got to get together in order to make these applications. So you can go look at that form now. It's available for download. It's also got in the documents, and we do have our write-up on the PPP loan programs, you know, the changes that were made in this law, available for you on the website where we, you know, host this session on the currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com website, the weekly updates. We have our full write-up there, and that has the list of all the documents you have to be submitted to show your payroll, self-employment numbers. Generally, they're all the things to document you qualify for the loan. And the only caveat is, you know, if you are going to ask for a loan of $150,000 or less, you do not have to document the drop in revenue, though apparently you can. But you are going to have to document that drop in revenue before you're going to be able to apply for forgiveness. So it's not as if you're going for a small loan, you'll never have to show your drop in revenue. It's just you don't have to do it when applying. I guess their theory was that maybe a small company might not have the really, really good accounting records right now. It's going to take them a long time to get that data together. We want them to apply right away. So the client is one who definitely has dropped by 25%, but the records are going to take a while to get together and shape. The bank will be able to look at them. So we're allowed to delay that until later. Okay. As I said, so if the loan requested is, and I think this is important, like I said, more than $150,000, you got to submit documents for your revenue to document your revenue decrease. If it's less than that, you do not have to submit the documents now, but, and this is really important, remember, your clients have to understand this because I can see people thinking, oh, if I ask for less than $150,000, I don't have to show the revenue drop. That's not what it says. It says you don't need to show the revenue drop when you apply for the loan, but you are going to have to show the revenue drop when you try to get forgiveness. And now you might think, oh, well, if I just, let's say I just like this nice low interest rate loan. So, okay, I just want to go for forgiveness and say, oops, sorry, my revenue actually went up by 70% every quarter last year. Bad me. You know, I don't qualify for forgiveness. I'd be a little careful there. You're still going to sign the form, and the client's going to sign that form and the attestation that says that they had the drop. And I think it's going to be a major problem if it appears they had no idea, you know, do they have a reasonable reason for believing they have the 25% drop? I think the SBA will probably, but again, we don't know how it's going to work, but I would think conceptually, they'll probably be okay if you thought you had a 25% drop and we discover you had a 24.9% drop was the biggest drop in a quarter. So you didn't qualify, they might understand you missing that. They probably won't understand you missing the fact that when your revenue went up by 70% every quarter, that you somehow thought it gone down 25% in one. They might have trouble believing that. Therefore, you signed a false attestation. And if you read your attestations, you're told that if you lie about any of those, and that includes saying I got a 20% drop when I knew I didn't, there was no chance I had one, That's technically a violation of federal law, and you might be spending time in the federal slammer. So maybe you'd prefer not to do that. Just say it in that case. The IFR also tells us on the second draw loan program, if a borrower has, I love this term, unresolved issues with the first loan. And what they mean by that is the lender has done their work and approved. It's gone on to the SBA. The SBA is now investigating because they're thinking maybe they didn't qualify for the loan. They didn't do something right. They didn't spend the money on the right things. So they're investigating these potential problems with the first loan. The SBA is under a bit of pressure after the first program with these reports we had of people setting up fake companies, getting these loans, using loans to buy Lamborghinis or whatever other sort of thing they might have. I don't know if we ever had Lamborghini. We had some very expensive cars, though. I think there's at least one Lambo in there. That was embarrassing. So they're going to be checking for that. If they discover, so the lender won't necessarily know that the SBA is investigating. So when the lender sends in the second application, second draw, they've looked at it. They basically have approved it. They send it on to the SBA. The SBA now is not going to tell them right away. It's going to tell them right away. I should say, will tell them right away that this company under investigation on the first loan. So we're going to notify you, and we're not going to authorize you to release the funds yet. They won't give the magic number necessary to have the loan guaranteed and to put it into the PPP loan program. So basically, that means we're on hold. Now, the SBA did say they're going to expedite their review to determine if the borrower was eligible. So conceptually, the idea is we are going to take a look at, so we will try to speed this up and get an answer. So the theory being, if it turns out that, okay, everything's fine, we'll be able to get our PPP2 loan money to them. We'll move this review to the front of the stack, is their theory, if we run into that problem in this case. Now, the other big thing is, because of that, and again, this concern about review, the SBA now has indicated, this is not in the IFR, but this has actually been indicated in numerous reports we've seen in the financial press, that we're not going to see approval come as quickly. The SBA administrators, the SBA basically staff was talking with the press when they released the IFRs, and shortly thereafter. They said, look, we're not going to approve as quickly as the first program. With the first program, it was almost instantaneous. When the bank submitted, they would turn it around very quickly and approve funding. At least once they got in the SBA system. This time, the SBA is going to conduct initially an automated review. They're going to check third-party documents, going to check some reports, going to look for some history of this company existing so people can't just set up fake companies that have never existed. So they're going to be checking that. If the automated review seems to find a problem, there's no evidence of this company existing, they'll kick it out for manual review. So the catch is, even if your company is one that's going to clear automated review easily, it's still likely to take until the following business day for the SBA to get that clearance done and to let the bank know it's okay to disperse. So it's not going to be right away. And if, in fact, the automated system indicates, we're not sure this is valid, then it's going to have to kick out for a manual review, which obviously could take quite a while longer to be done. So just understand that's part of the program. And, you may know that if you have brand new companies, it may not come through that quickly. The SBA is going to look at this. As I noted, the simplified application program for loans for $50,000 or less will still apply to the second draw loans. But some people said, but you're telling me they got to submit this document. They got to submit documents with their forgiveness application only if they didn't submit documents showing they qualified for the loan, not the forgiveness, but the loan initially, because they didn't submit their documentation for the reduction of revenue with the application. If they don't do it with the application, they haven't gotten it to the bank before they go for forgiveness, they have to send it in with forgiveness. But all the rest of the one-page form stays as is. Everything else should be the same as before. It'll qualify for that program. As I said, the revised forms, they came out late on Friday. There's a lot of reasons to expect this rollout may be very rocky. First thing is, obviously, we are yet again trying to rush this up, get it up and running nationwide on a very, very short timetable. Remember, it wasn't until December 27th, by the way, in the middle of a time where a lot of people are gone and not working, wasn't until December 27th that we even knew that we were going to be able to, we're going to be doing this program. And we just got the IFRs out on Wednesday, and we didn't get the forms and the information about the systems the bank's going to have to use out until Friday. That's not a recipe for a smooth rollout come Monday. So be aware of that. Also be aware, what I've seen as stats is the number of banks that will be able to offer if they were ready on Monday is about 10% of all banks. But of course, they're smaller banks. We're not talking about 10% of all lending, but just 10% of all banks overall. And they're going to be on the smaller end up front. So if you know of such banks, you know, your client may want to look that way. Just, you know, and try to see about getting in early. You know, that'd be where you check if they really, really want the money right away. The larger banks will come on later. And remember, we do have these pools of funds that have been, you know, set aside for different groups. So if your client doesn't fall in one of the groups, we may run into the fact that, you know, they're going to be in a more generic group and they may not get the money until the SBA has become clear. They're not going to have problems funding the other groups they're supposed to fund. You should expect to receive a lot more FAQs from the SBA. So we're going to see FAQs and probably even some IFRs, some more IFRs come out from the SBA on the program, just like before. So things will keep changing. Be aware of that. Or we're going to finally get guidance that we haven't had. And that means, you know, we're going to be guessing about how that guidance turns out initially. And then we're going to hope we guessed right. That's where we go. Issues remaining, there are still some issues. Clearly, there's a lot of things left about how the whole forgiveness process is going to work for the second draw loans. We don't have that information out yet. You know, like what kind of documentation will we submit for those other four categories? That's not been covered yet, so we expect a whole, and remember, last time we had a whole separate set of guidance for forgiveness. Expect that again this time with more of the details on those things. And don't forget as well, before you get too far along, please remember, Congress can always modify this program as well. So there's, you know, you can't assume that this is going to be totally unchanging. Very well, Congress could extend the program if they feel it's necessary. Congress might do various other things, you know, because remember, we got the PPPFA in June. So essentially, a little less than 3 months after they passed the initial program, they came back and did the second set of rules and changed rules and did things. I wouldn't be totally shocked if that happened again. Just fair warning. So, yeah, keep your eye on the programs and what's happening as we go to them, because things may change. You know, keep your eye on the developments as we go forward. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for January the 11th, 2021. I actually remember the right year. You know, if you have any questions or comments, we've got them. You can send them to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also find me online. currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com is where we post all of our updates. I also do post links to updates on Twitter. My handle there at edzollers. I participate in the Connect groups for the state societies in Arizona, New Jersey. I watch Minnesota, Washington, Illinois. So we have those various things happening. So you can keep your eye on those. And otherwise, we're going to be seeing how things go. So with that, we'll go ahead and there I go. I forgot I accidentally blanked the screen out on you there for a second. I didn't realize how I managed to do it. So I got it there. So we are going to be kind of, you know, looking at those items. So again, wherever that goes, we'll keep our eye on it and keep things going. Otherwise, hopefully I'll see you here next week. And we'll bring you more developments here in the area of current federal tax developments.